Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. I've gotten a lot of feedback from listeners that you would all be interested in history-focused episodes that obviously hit on the political and policy themes of the realignment, but also just tell interesting and relevant stories. So here's what we're going to do to offer a bit of signposting. Every Friday that doesn't feature an Ask Me Anything episode with Sagar via our Supercast subscription, I'm going to do an unpaywalled episode focused on American and global history. First up, today's episode is with NPR's Steve Drummond on his new book, The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. This is a particularly interesting conversation in light of my episode of Rep. Mike Gallagher earlier this year. His China Select Committee could take plenty of notes from Truman's efforts before and during World War II. I'll be expanding my thoughts on the book and this episode in the Realignment Substack, so be sure to subscribe at the link in the show notes or go to therealignment.substack.com. And yes, that is a little different from the Supercast website, so be sure to click the proper show note in the podcast player of your choice. To wrap, it feels cheesy to say, but in light of the disastrous drop in NAEP, U.S. history, and civics test scores amongst eighth graders this past year, it's more important than ever to listen to these sorts of conversations and support the work of authors like Steve. So you can purchase The Watchdog at our bookshop, link in the show notes. Hope you all enjoy this conversation, and definitely let me know what upcoming books or previously written books you'd love to cover on the show, along with other areas of history and politics. See you all next time. Stephen Drummond, welcome to The Realignment.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks, Marshall.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here. I think I've really wanted to do a lot more history-facing content that obviously could speak to the present moment. I think this is actually the perfect book to kick everything off with. So I gave a bit of an intro so people can really let us dive into things. What was the Truman Committee?
Sure. In the late 1940s, or after World War II broke out in September 1939, 2 years before the United States would join the war, there was an immediate recognition in some parts of the government, notably Franklin Roosevelt and the Roosevelt administration, that the United States very quickly needed to get ready for war. At that time, the United States Army was ranked in size 17th in the world behind Romania. So there was a lot of work to be done. Army camps needed to be built. The Navy needed modernized. Airplanes, tanks, trucks, army camps, all these things needed to be built, and they needed to be built in a hurry. So the government was on a spending spree. And what the Truman Committee did, both before Pearl Harbor and after, was take a look at all that money being spent and try and figure out, was it being spent wisely? Was it being wasted? And by all accounts, throughout the course of the war, the Truman Committee saved the country billions of dollars and probably an unknown number of lives on the battlefield.
You know, this is interesting because I'd love to know why you think this is the moment to tell this story. We're kind of in the middle of a Harry Truman resurgence from a like popular recognition perspective, but this is a specific part of Harry Truman's story. Like, why is this the time to tell this story?
I think there's a lot of relevance to today. We keep seeing time after time, $1.5 trillion defense bills to recover from the pandemic, or promote this or that initiative. Every single time one of these giant spending programs comes out, somebody pops up and says, you know what, we need another Truman Committee to look after this. So time and again. And then since 1944, when Truman resigned from the committee, there have been many big congressional investigation, the Kefauver Committee in the 50s, the investigation of President Kennedy's assassination, the 2010, the collapse of the financial institutions, even last year, the January 6th Committee. Many of these committees take many of the same principles as Truman pioneered at that time, trying to be bipartisan, trying to get the facts straight, not seeking headlines or publicity, trying to do the public service. And so oftentimes, I think when there are these big congressional investigations, Watergate, I think many of them trace their roots right back to the Truman Committee.
You know, it's interesting. You giving that example of every time there is a scandal from the, you know, fall of Kabul to the end of the war on terror, at this point, it's just become a cliche to say we need a new Truman Committee. Those committees, separate from the ones you listed, have just not been A, empirically effective to the way you established at the start of the episode. Like, once again, like saving billions while also saving lives. What basically happened over the next 60 years? And I think the post-Vietnam like CIA investigations would be an example of an effective use of a committee. But those seems to be the exceptions. What made it fundamentally different?
Very much so. And I just see every day, you know, I'm a journalist who works in Washington, D.C. The toxic atmosphere here in Washington, the contempt that many people hold the government, the inability of the two parties to work together. And so here I've spent the last 4 years in the 1940s. Truman built a small committee with five senators, three Democrats and two Republicans. And here's, I think, a key fact. During Truman's time as chairman, the Truman Committee put out 32 reports. Every single one of them was unanimous and bipartisan. That Truman spent a lot of time building consensus, getting the Republican members of the committee on board. And that, I think, was super effective. I think it made the trust in the committee. Here's another way of looking at it. During the war, there were dozens of congressional investigations into this or that, many of them covering the same ground that the Truman Committee was covering. Only one was guaranteed front page news. Only one vaulted its chairman into the White House. And it was, I think, this hard work to get the facts straight, to be bipartisan, to quietly get a lot of work done without making a big deal out of it. I think it was very effective. And I think some of these investigations today, some of the politicians in Washington today could learn a lot from that.
You know, an obvious answer to my question would be the differentiating factor between the Truman Committee and, let's say, investigations moving forward is just the stakes. It's World War II. Obviously, they're going to get it together. But as you point out at the start of the book, during World War I and the Civil War, you had similarly high, I mean, obviously World War I is less high stakes than the Civil War was, but you see similarly high stakes from a national survival perspective. Yet you saw ineffective committees. Ineffective committees in the case of World War I, they're happening after the fact, they're hyper-politicized, they kind of drag on and on and on. And then the Civil War Committee, I think in one of my favorite quotes of all time, Robert E. Lee says, this is from the book, quote, "The committee was worth at least two Confederate divisions," in terms of how bungling and ineffective it was. So why was the pre-World War II version, where there are similar stakes, ineffective in those two examples?
So just like I was talking about, the Committee on the Conduct of War during the Civil War was a thorn in Abraham Lincoln's side from the get-go. It was done in a lot of ways in a partisan way to get at Lincoln rather than in a public service way to figure out what is the best way to run the war. Truman, by the way, was a great student of history, and he read the entire proceedings of that committee, and he learned from it. One of the things the Truman Committee said from the get-go, we will not investigate strategy, we will not investigate conduct on the battlefield. In other words, Truman defined his goal, and he stuck to it. That's one of the things. And then Truman looked at these committees after World War I. There were 117 of them. One of them, the war ended in 1918. One of those committees was still in business in 1937. The money was spent. Everything was wasted by that time. Truman's idea was, let's look at these expenditures. Let's look at the spending program while it's happening. And let's see what we can do to fix it. And then time and time again, Truman would pick up the phone and call somebody in the Pentagon, or his assistants would, or they would, and quietly the problem would go away without a lot of fanfare. And that was something that Franklin Roosevelt and the Democratic Party leadership greatly appreciated.
Is the key story here, and this is what a good explanation for why committees haven't been particularly effective moving forward, the fact that Harry Truman and the committee, obviously with the Democratic majority, were aligned with the executive branch?
Very much so. And then again, a lot of it, I really think, has to do with Truman's leadership itself. We can overblow this and say, having said that, I read Robert Caro's book, The Master of the Senate. I don't know if you're familiar with
it. Yeah, of course.
But he talks about during the Vietnam War, Lyndon Johnson has the idea to create a new Truman Committee, taking all the lessons Truman learned and flipping them on their side. They wouldn't really deal with substance. The press releases were more substantive than the actual hearings themselves. And like a lot of these committees, it eventually faded away, it frittered away the press and the public kind of rolled their eyes at it. Truman's committee, time and time again, would come out and tell American people things they didn't know about what was going on during the war. Again, a very strange circumstance, given that Truman was a Democratic senator, criticizing the administration of his own party. It's a little unusual.
Yeah, it's really interesting too, because something you said when you were critiquing the Civil War congressional investigations were they focused on the conduct of the war. And I think it's easy to say, well, that makes sense that you would take the lesson from the Truman Committee that, you know, you don't say, look, we're going to debate whether it's truly the right call to go into, let's say, North Africa before starting a front in Europe. Are we going to do a Europe first policy versus Japan? That doesn't make any sense. Like, we should focus on Pearl Harbor. I could see all sorts of arguments sort of against that idea. So basically what I'm asking you is, how should Congress in this context of this story think about its role in wartime when the executive branch has certain advantages when it comes to military strategy?
Right. And time again, Truman was asked to look into these things. He said, I'm not touching it. He wasn't in Europe. He wasn't in North Africa. And he refused. And that's, I think, one of the big lessons we can learn from this. In my lifetime, I've seen these commissions get formed, and they're, you know, frankly, politicians are very interested in getting on TV and are having their sound bites or their tweets look good. And they're perfectly willing to spout off about strategic or national security implications they don't really know about. Truman resisted that time and time again. I think it's a decent lesson.
And this is the key thing from what you just said. It's not that the legislative branch doesn't have a role in input. It's that the venue for that is not a committee with hyper-specific mission-oriented goals. I think that's what I take it from what you just said.
Exactly. He wrote a very narrow mission statement that they would look into the defense spending program, and actually it ended up being quite broad. It gave them the leeway to look into a lot of things. But Truman himself time and again would say, we are not looking into strategy. We are not looking into battlefield conduct. Several times the Pentagon came back to him and said, hey, he would ask for information about a new bomber or some weapon. And they would say, you know what? That's a strategic thing. We're not going to talk to you about that. Truman, I'll give you the best example. Several times Truman and his committee stumbled across huge expenditures in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Los Alamos, New Mexico. He sent a man out to Hanford, Washington, to look into these giant expenditures. George Marshall, chief of staff of the Army, came over to Truman's office. That's top secret. That is a big, giant spending program. Hands off. Truman backed away. Possibly he could have saved some money in this giant expenditure. Possibly he could have blown the lid off the biggest secret of the war, which was the Manhattan Project, the project to create the atomic bomb.
You know, it's so interesting. That's another good example that comes to mind. The balance between secrecy and openness when it comes to the question of accountability. I think a good example that comes to mind from the book is in one of the reports, there was a write-up like analyzing America's like pursuit aircraft. So like famously, mm-hmm. like we made excellent modern bombers in the 30s. So the B-17, the B-24, the B-25, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where we were desperately behind was in quote unquote like pursuit aircraft. So like this is the equivalent of like the BF-109 if you're a German, or like the Spitfire if you're British. We had the P-40 Warhawk. And in their report, as you tell in the story, they said, we have this fighter, redacted, the P-40 Warhawk, that isn't effective. When you're thinking about, or as they're thinking about, like, what's redacted, how are people held accountable, what is elevated, how do you think about the balance between just keeping that fighter, you know, I think it was Curtis who made that.
Curtis.
If it's Curtis who's making that, does making that public hold them more accountable, or is there a balance to be held there?
Very much so. And it's a really tough call. And there's no great answer here. In some ways, the Germans certainly read the United States newspapers and they would learn these things. And there was genuine concerns about that. At the same time, the Curtis company had a big, giant contract with the federal government, didn't like having it made public that its fighter plane wasn't as good as the ones made by North American or Lockheed. So there's always that trade-off between putting information out there to the public good versus the very genuine need to protect military secrets. And a couple of times, the Truman Committee ran up against the limits of what a congressional investigation could accomplish. Eisenhower would later call it the military-industrial complex. Sometimes Truman would find something very, very wrong going on in the war program. The Pentagon learned during the war, they could shut him down by saying, oh, national security, top secret, we can't talk about that. There wasn't a heck of a lot Truman could do. And in a couple of instances, the Truman Committee's failure stemmed from the limits that a congressional investigation can accomplish.
Yeah. And I think that if people think of the situation in the defense industry today, the problems, quote unquote, are pretty straightforward. But could you just, in as best you can, sum up what the quote unquote problem or challenge the committee was facing was? So, for example, he kind of summed this up. I think the examples would just be monopoly, cost overruns, profiteering. Like, what were those problems that were narrowly mission focused?
There were several. Yeah, shortages were key. So if you look at it, the United States was a peacetime capitalist economy, way less government control than we have now. Things like Social Security were considered, outright communism or whatever. And now suddenly the nation had to turn to a war economy in which, take a couple of examples, steel or gasoline. Oh, who should get steel? The Navy shipyard building warships? Wait, the tank factory in Detroit? Or wait a minute, the company building merchant ships that are desperately needed on the West Coast? Somebody had to sort this out, and it wasn't going to be the free market. The government was going to have to pick and choose who would get what and how much it costs. And that required a whole lot of degree of management in the economy that had never happened before, and that a lot of people were, especially big giant corporations, were very much opposed to. So here's Truman kind of inserting himself in the process, saying, hey, this isn't working. Hey, why are there widespread shortages of aluminum? Why isn't aluminum being produced? Why is aluminum still going to the automobile manufacturers when it should be going into airplanes? The decision to get Detroit to stop making automobiles is exactly the kind of thing we're talking about during the war. They didn't want to stop. Finally, it wasn't until the Truman Committee reported on it. And finally, in 1942, I believe, the government came out and said, okay, no more cars for the duration of the war. That was a very difficult and controversial. It seems easy now. Why are we making cars? We need tanks. At that time, hugely controversial, and it took a long time to get there. Those are the kind of the challenges that the committee was facing.
One that's interesting in terms of the problems that he really identified, and I think this is from I guess this is the ultimate degree of like Monday morning quarterbacking, is Truman seemed specifically deeply focused on including small businesses in the programs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And is using that as part of his evaluatory standard for the defense industrial base. But I guess from my perspective, that seems almost sort of political assessment rather than one inherently interested in the best outcome. So could you just kind of like, back if I'm just like looking at, so basically my point is, if we're looking at the year 1942 and we need landing craft, the first question to me isn't, okay, like, is this money going to a big corporation or is it going to a small business? Because there's a way of saying that small business is inefficient. Small business isn't going to be able to be put into this big scaling thing. How would you think about this debate?
I totally agree with you. And I think this was one of the weaknesses of Truman and maybe the committee a little bit. And if we step back a little bit and let's talk about why. Truman was the last president to not have a college degree. He was a high school graduate. He was a small businessman himself in Missouri. He had run a business and seen it fail. He had struggled with this. He had been a farmer. And so he carried, I'm from the Midwest myself, and I know very well, people in that time and place had a deep suspicion of some giant corporation or bank far away in New York City or in Detroit. And so Truman came into the committee thinking, and his mail showed a lot. Hey, how come GM or Ford got this big contract? And yet you point out a really good point. If the country needed hundreds of tanks and to be built in a day, the expertise to build them was with General Motors and Ford Motor Company and Chrysler Corporation or whoever. It wasn't going to be some small businessman in Missouri. So yes, it was somewhat political. It just reflected Truman's, in this case, somewhat limited worldview. And it was kind of a failure. He hammered this small business drum throughout the war. It really wasn't practical to take some of these huge defense contracts to build ships and tanks and all these things and farm them out to little tiny businesses around the country. They did make some progress here. Having said that, as you point out, not only was it Truman's worldview, it was extremely politically popular. And many of the letters he received were talking about small businessmen saying, hey, thanks for fighting the fight. So again, the Truman Committee is often kind of held up as some non-political thing. Not true. Truman was a politician just like everybody else in the Senate or in Washington.
Yeah. And could you speak more about the monopoly side of this thing? Because another thing that comes to mind as you're reading this book is if you think that the situation of monopoly is one where you do have all these different North American, Northrop is a different company, even like Grumman, Boeing, et cetera, versus today where you have a hyper consolidated defense industry. So when he's describing monopoly conditions, it's like, well, buddy, look at this thing 60 years later. So just describe like the American industry, quote unquote, yep, as we're looking at the ecosystem.
Very much so. It's much less concentrated than it was now. And yet, even at that time, there were airplane manufacturers all over the country. But a lot of it, World War II took the thing of you know, to build the B-29 Super Fortress. There was only one company in the world at that time that was capable of building that airplane. Having said that, hundreds and thousands of other companies had a role in subcontracting and doing all this stuff the same way. I grew up in Detroit. Three big companies and then this sort of network of tentacles of little subcontractors doing all the work. But it was very much clear during the war that without these giant corporations that had vast experience in how to make a factory appear on a farm outside Detroit almost overnight and start cranking out four-engine bombers eventually at the rate of one every 63 minutes, like that was unprecedented. And that did play a lot, an incredibly huge role in winning the war, as much so or more than the efforts on the battlefield. So, you know, it was just a very different time. And then a lot of the consolidation we see today began then. As say, Northrop Grumman, they're now the same thing. Lockheed Martin, which was a Glenn Martin company that was making bombers. A lot of these big conglomerates in aviation or aerospace were separate companies back in that time.
I want to kind of backtrack on my post-op dunking on the focus on small business, because I think to your point, you said this earlier really eloquently, which is ultimately these are choices of political economy. So this isn't a free market. So the government in some degree is making choices about what the wartime and also the post-war economy is going to look like. So I guess the defense of some degree of bias towards small businesses is just an awareness of the role the government would play in basically propping those up. So I guess what I kind of asked for a corrective around is, if we think of the mythology around World War II, the triumphs are, you know, building a B-24 bomber in a day instead of like weeks, or building a ship in weeks instead of months. Those are very much those big industrial scale examples. Can you think of any examples in your research or the story where it's like, here's a small business, it actually is that true American story. There was this small businessman who had an innovation and fit into this scale and it all made sense.
During the war, there were countless examples and the press loved to single them out or this or that. I mean, the Truman Committee files are full of stories from inventors who would write in and they had invented something for the war. But the press loved to single out, I don't have specific examples, a family in Iowa somewhere that was making one little part in their home, manufacturing it or sewing it or whatever, and feeding it into a giant corporation. It was real and it did happen. I'll give you another example. About halfway through in 1942, the Truman Committee glommed onto the notion of the helicopter. This guy named Igor Sikorsky had invented and been perfecting the helicopter on a small scale. He had tried to sell it to the military, no interest at all. By 1942, as submarines were seeking ships in the Atlantic Ocean, the Coast Guard, many others, everybody but the Navy had realized this was a really good idea. And here was this sort of entrepreneur trying to build this machine, couldn't really get into the door in the Navy department. So there were many, many examples. And it would be some years until Korea, really, before the helicopter would come into its own. But there were countless examples of small people tinkering away in their garage or their basement who came up with an idea that could help out and won the war. So there was a strong element of that. You're absolutely right. We should tell both sides of that story.
And I think you actually gave a helpful mission-oriented way of distinguishing what I think is a little more ineffective small business argument from I think effective one would have been, which is, look, these are big, massive organizations. You want to have a situation where new ideas, new approaches can be interjected into the system. And that's what startups are. That's what small businesses are. So I think the question, if I were on the Truman Committee, would be basically, are there enough backstops or alternate procedures that mean that big Navy isn't just taking whatever the boys at Boeing send up and interjecting something new?
It's funny that you say that. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but it was one of the key functions. Early in 1941, Hugh Fulton, who was the chief counsel who ran the committee underneath Truman, sent out a note to the staff. They were getting hot. By now, Truman had gone on the radio saying, hey, America, you know, write into us. Harry Truman, Washington, D.C., tell me what's going on. They were getting countless letters, thick files of letters from inventors or people who had this or that idea for winning the war. A lot of them were what, at the time, they were called crackpots, and they went into the file. But Hugh Fulton had a rule. Each one got a look by one of his investigators. Each one got a response. And he was very careful to say, yes, a lot of these are crackpots, but maybe there's something in there. We should look at every single one and see. Because again, you're right. The Navy bureaucracy, time and time again, was very unwilling to change, very unwilling to embrace new ideas. And so the Truman Committee saw its role as trying to be a bit of a backstop on it.
You know, I kind of skipped through this question, but could you just talk about who Harry Truman was at this point in his career? Because this isn't the Harry Truman who propagates the Truman Doctrine. This isn't the vice president. This isn't the atomic bomb. Like, this is a very specific, somewhat underwhelming, I think is sort of the spirit that's captured. So tell that story. Like, who is he at this point in his life?
Harry Truman came to the Senate in 1934, and he was widely and derogatorily considered the senator from Pendergast. Tom Pendergast was the machine boss of Kansas City politics, handpicked Truman to run for the Senate, and Truman won election. So when he got in Washington, everybody thought he was just a corrupt, crooked politician sent there by the Kansas City machine. It wasn't really true. Truman, however, was good friends with Tom Pendergast. He was happy to do the political patronage that the time demanded. And yet, Truman kept his own hands clean. Time and again, he refused to get rich off of the potential for corruption of being an elected politician. Having said that, he came to the Senate, he kept his head down, he kept his mouth shut, and basically, he did almost nothing there for 6 years that anyone noticed. In 1941, when he formed this committee, virtually unknown outside of Missouri, and many people in Missouri couldn't have named the state's junior senator. And then suddenly, because of finding his feet with this investigative committee, 3 years later, he was vice president of the United States. So having said that, Truman had served in World War I. He was a combat veteran. He was a captain in the artillery. He had led his men into combat. And then he had been in the 20s and 30s, a county judge, is more like a county commissioner in Jackson County, Missouri. He had learned public service. He had learned how to talk to people. He was not a great public speaker. He was learning that a little bit, never would be a great public speaker. But basically, virtually unknown politician, but the foundations were there for what would make him vice president.
I want to get some thoughts from you on, I think, a degree of frustration you're going to experience about a world that no longer exists, in the sense that, so as you said, he didn't graduate from college, but he's able to become a lieutenant in the Missouri National Guard, because back then the men would literally vote on who became an officer, which is by definition the opposite of a lot of the meritocratic advancements we've made in the post-World War II era. And once again, he also doesn't have a college degree. He's very much like a failure in business, and he's only able to keep moving up because a crooked old-timey machine is selecting him. Yet all those processes basically worked. So I'm having a hard time and I think a lot of people do, and this is kind of why we're in this weird like post-meritocratic backlash of the SAT-driven meritocracy doesn't seem to produce leaders of that caliber to the same degree. So there's no takeaway. I'm not proposing we go back to the voting system for officers. But yeah, I'd love to hear you reflect on that.
I mean, it's absolutely true. And I think you say it's a nuanced thing. Back then, of course, there were plenty of self-serving, crooked, racist politicians in the Senate and the House. You know, Truman is the exception to the rule, perhaps, as in today. There are certainly dedicated public servants in the government, and there are also ones who are seeking headlines or, you know, taking advantage of social media or it was a different time. But and yet I see a lot of parallels for today. Truman rose, as you say, in a meritocracy. Truman rose to the top in a way that still happens once in a while. And then at the same time, there were other politicians at the time who were undeserving of their role in office. That happens today too.
No, it's interesting. I take a lot of optimism from the study of history, just in the sense that you read the story of it you're describing, and it seems that despite the challenges we have today, like they are not the challenges one would wake up with on December 8th, 1941. So I guess my question for you is, do you come away from this history thinking of, you know, the man or the woman in the case, like meets the moment, like does history, could you look, I feel like, let me put it this way, I feel like you could look at America's situation in 1939 and be very despairing, especially in contrast to the rising fascists. Do you just think that history produces opportunity? And then, like, how do you think about this?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. Watching the toxic atmosphere in Washington today, watching the, you know, absolute lack of bipartisanship, it's easy to be a little despairing of the time. But again, you can look at 1939, say the same thing. 25% unemployment, a nation woefully unprepared for war, hungry people not being fed. These are rough times. And so, you know, sometimes leaders rise up to the top and sometimes they don't. I don't know. I too find examples. I just read Adam Hochschild's recent book about the
American
end of
Midnight,
World War II.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in a way, it was really shocking to be like, wow, the country really went off the rails for a couple of years there. This is really scary. And then there was something reassuring about it, saying, well, yes, the company has gone the wrong direction before, and we came back from it and survived. And that was somehow in that book inspiring, too. I think the World War II period could say the same thing. Or even if you look at, you know, Lincoln would be the best example. The country was going very, very wrong in the 1850s, and a leader rises in the right moment at the right spot. You know, you're probably as cynical as I is this sort of great man theory of history or whatever. I don't know. Truman took a lot of effort to make his own way here. He got this little tiny appropriation to create this committee. It was his hard work. You know, he's pulling all nighters on this thing to make it successful. And he took the care to reject a lot of the things that were shown what didn't work. He didn't hire a political hack to run the administration of the committee. He took very care to put decent, hardworking senators join him on the committee. It was kind of a B list of hardworking but not super flashy senators. So there's so many different variables that go into these things beyond the notion that, you know, Harry Truman was somehow destined to do this.
You know, it's interesting. The one modification I'd offer on the, you know, great man theory of history thing is I think we could adopt a great man or woman theory of politics, in the sense that, and this is the way you tell the story, Harry Truman is making very specific decisions that 99 other senators, there weren't 99 senators back then, right? 96 other senators, I believe, would not have made. Yep. So I think we could really take away from the story of it during moments of intensity. Who's in the chair matters, the values that person has matters, and how they can and cannot learn from different history lessons. So I think that's the one modification I'd offer. So okay, so in this last section, I'd love to ask a couple more questions. So number one, do you think that so I better articulate the question then. So let's just say, like, if you're imagining there's like a Harry Truman reading this book, that being, you could be anything from a state legislator to like a small business person, a National Guardsman, like whatever, what would you want their takeaway to be?
Yeah, I think there are some lessons for leadership here. I think some lessons in consensus building. I think some lessons in sort of not needing the limelight, not needing the spotlight. I think there are, I think of it, if you use the Truman Committee as kind of a management study, like I said, it was very pleasurable to watch him grow into the job in these 4 years. He started out very shaky, very deferential to the powers that be that were coming for his committee. 3 years later, you see him much more willing to push back in a respectful, civil way. You see him, again, very deferential. He was happy to hand off the chairmanship on any given date, even to one of his Republican colleagues, to let them take the lead. So I think there's quite a bit you could learn from there if there's a Harry Truman out there today reading this book.
Another guest that came on the podcast this week, this episode will be out on Friday, but this aired, this episode I'm referencing were on Thursday. It's a guy named Andrew Hohen. He was at the New York Times, and he's talking about defense policy. And, you know, the book that he's talking about is very much oriented around the idea that we should be open to difference, and we should be open to the fact that we're not able to just find the perfect mission and the perfect articulation, and you should be aware of a world of randomness. We started this conversation by arguing it was so important that they were just so laser focused on this, and that. So I guess more from a, you know, guest making different guests pit themselves against each other unhelpfully. What would you say is like the devil's advocacy against like the strict, very zoomed in focus?
Sure. There were mistakes on the battlefield. There were mistakes of military strategy being made. You pointed out several of them. Why are we going into North Africa? Why, you know, was that a diversion? Was that merely an effort to preserve the British Empire? You know, there were a lot of policy decisions that were hugely political and were, Eisenhower in 1944 was warned off of racing to Berlin to go chase, you know, a sort of perceived Nazi stronghold in the Alps or wherever it was. There were critical decisions to be made of military strategy, and Truman could have gone there, or some other committee could have done there. So yeah, there's, you know, by choosing a narrow laser focus, other decisions weren't criticized. Fortunately, the United States government is big enough. There were plenty of people in the press and in the government to take on some of those other things.
You just hinted at something that really defines this era. And I think if there's ever an equivalent situation in terms of the 21st century, it's going to have a similar dynamic, which is just you're having members of Congress, you're having lawyers, you're having, and once again, it's men because we're talking about the 1940s, like men, I'm not just being old timey, like the men of industry from Sears Roebuck are coming in. If you're ever in a situation similar to this, you're basically having to have all these different parts of the American coalitional ecosystem come together. If you're an industrialist who's making washing machines, you have to start thinking about production of tanks. What would your advice be for just basically anyone? Because this is what total war looks like. In a society that's in the middle of a total war, everything gets mixed together. What would your advice and takeaways be for the awkwardness or difficult parts that will come there?
It seemed like, I don't know, there might be some cynical things. Oftentimes, as that time, as it would be now, that Washington machine manufacturer could watch his, to use the gender of the time, could watch his competitor whose washing machines weren't as good quality, but who had better connections in Washington, D.C., get the contract. I mean, again, there's some of the thing. It's not just what you do and how you run your business, but your connections and the networking. That was to be cynical about it, there was no different then than it is now. And many of the dealings that the Truman Committee was looking into that didn't really make the headlines were like, hey, I make really good military uniforms, but the guy down the street, his uniforms are crummy, but he got the contract. Why is that? Like, politics is politics, never changes.
And this is a history book, so I'm not asking for the politicized version of this answer if you don't want to give it, but I think if we're to articulate what went wrong with both the committees before the Truman Committee and many of the committees after the committee, probably really outside the CIA investigation because it was so laser focused, what would you say you would advise a ambitious, smart politician to focus on, given what you're describing? Because key thing, takeaway from what you're telling me here is, it's not that there isn't a lot of serious analysis to be done about the war on terror period for the past 20 years, but from a pure, how is this going to change the world and result in billions of dollars saved, fixing a system and saving lives? That's backwards facing in the same way that the post-1918 World War I analyses were. It's easy to, and I interviewed the chair of the China Select Committee, Mike Gallagher, and I think the China Select Committee is a good idea, but that by its nature is going to get into values-based debates away from the empirical ones. So where would you identify maybe the forward-facing opportunities? Because once again, the key thing is this committee started before December 7th. So before there was a war on, it had gotten started with its work.
I'm not sure I'll have a major answer here because I don't know the answer, but I'll give you a couple of micro responses. Truman realized early on, he did learn some stuff in his first term in the Senate, that the committee staff was a huge role, like hiring good staff and good people to work on it. He called the attorney general. He said, I want the best prosecutor you have. that was very different than the way those committees usually run. It would go to somebody who had just lost election or a prominent private lawyer who would happily put this feather in his cap, but not really invest in the time. The committee staff were really important. I'll give you another example. In 2020, in April, Congress passed a $2 trillion relief package. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House at the time, Speaker of the House?
Yeah, she was Speaker then.
Yeah. Nancy Pelosi went on the Colbert Report, and Colbert said to her, "Tell me about the Truman Committee." It was one of many times over the last 50 years that a big spending plan was passed in Congress. And immediately the calls were, we need a new Truman Committee. There was a House committee created. It was going to do the same thing. It was going to look into how this $2 trillion got spent. Name that committee? I can't. Never. It held a couple of hearings. I followed it for a while I was writing the book during the time. It fizzled away. The communications is important. The Truman approached the early work of the Truman Committee politically as well. Army camps was low-hanging fruit. He put out a report and made a big splash. I will tell you, in one of the biggest criticisms of the committee is very early on, Black leaders in the country reached out and said, "Well, hey, you're looking into the defense buildup? You should be looking at the rampant discrimination in defense plans. You should be looking at the rampant discrimination in the military against Black people." Truman took a pass on this, pretty much. He had scheduled some hearings and they went away. But the bottom line was, it was politically unpopular in his own party. Franklin Roosevelt was very interested in preserving his strength in the South and not alienating racist white voters in the South. And so, in other words, Truman dodged the issue. So there was politics involved here, as there is in all things, and communications. Those are important things too. I don't think I really answered your question because I don't know, but those are some of the examples of reasons why this committee, as opposed to the dozens of other investigative committees, became the one.
No, and you did answer my question, just because I think you actually gave a very effective playbook for how a leader could actually approach a big bailout, of which we assume there'll be other bailouts, other government spending programs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the other key thing too, that puts a bookend to this, is you just illustrated the downside of consensus politics, in the sense that you're saying, like, look at Harry Truman, three Democrats, two Republicans, he feels all this consensus. Well, there is a cost to consensus. Consensus cannot be treated. And from a mission-oriented perspective, consensus is important, but consensus is not necessarily a value in of itself. So here's just the wrapping question. I appreciate you referencing Robert Caro's LBJ biographies, because they're not just a story of 20th century America and like the personal biography of LBJ, but they're also like a meditation on power and how it works. What did writing and researching this story teach you about power, corruption, how DC works, any takeaways in the Robert Caroian sense? Very noting you didn't so. Have 30 years to ruminate on that.
But very much so. Don't you read Master of the Senate? You think, why can't someone do that today? Why can't somebody figure out how to make Congress or the Senate, the extremely dysfunctional Senate, work? I'm just fascinated by that topic. But I did watch Truman navigate these waters. He was very careful to do here. It's amazing how much time he spent talking to the majority leader, talking to his colleagues in the Senate, making sure he's stepping on toes, avoiding dangerous political waters that could have got him in big trouble. You know, it was very smartly done. And it's kind of a cool story to watch Truman figure this out. And I'm sure, I'm no doubt, these are skills that served him well when suddenly he became president of the United States.
That is an excellent place to leave it. Steve, this has been so much fun. Really enjoyed the book.
Same here.
And folks, should be sure to check it out. Thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Thanks, Marshall.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.